If you see something, say something. At Reply, weird things come with any weird story you find on the web, and you can help make weirdthings.com even weirder.
Mike Ray, former cop and body double for a world-famous action star, was ready to put show business behind him when he was asked to do one last favor for Hollywood's hottest new actress. All he had to do was find her the necklace from a forgotten film and not get killed in the process. From the insane house parties of Malibu and the reclusive mansions of Beverly Hills to the scorching California desert, Mike finds himself in a scandal involving one of the world's most eccentric billionaires, the Nevada Mafia, and a sadistic Estonian porn kingpin. To find the necklace, he'll have to blow the lid off a secret buried in the California desert that stretches back to ancient Egypt, with an irresistible client who won't take no for an answer. The job doesn't get him killed, she just might. Hollywood Pharaohs by Andrew Main has been described as a fast-paced love child of The Big Lebowski and Indiana Jones. Find out why readers have made this book one of the best reviewed in all of Amazon. It's Hollywood Pharaohs by Andrew Main, available for only $2.99 on the Amazon Kindle store. Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, ghouls and goblins, welcome to Weird Things, the podcast. This is an extra special edition. Why is it extra special? Because it's just me and Bri. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Mr. Brian Brushwood.
This is one of those rare occasions where what's special is what you're not getting. You're not getting our very own Harry Sasquatch, Justin Robert Young.
I like to think that it's like you're getting like the Tang without the water.
There you go.
But I'm afraid it's going to be like when you have that Kool-Aid packet without the sugar, and you're like, oh, I'm going to do straight Kool-Aid, and you're like, it's horrible.
Yeah. Although, I'll tell you, can I confess something that's going to sound horrific and gross, but is way awesome?
This is the guy that eats cup of noodle without water, so.
Okay, yeah. Then this is really saying something. I have lately taken to dipping celery stalks, just the corner of it, just the tip, in powdered lemonade, like Crystal Light lemonade, because like there's something about the blandness, or you know, there's that bite to the celery with the fusion of the super sweet and the sour all at once. It's actually very, very good. Sounds good.
You might be onto something. There is that weird food fusion. Like if you take like it's supposed to be like saltine crackers and lemon juice or something, you can fake like apple pie or something.
What?
Yeah,
I believe it.
Somebody's going to try that and throw up, and they're going to be like, what?
So is this going to be the whole show? We're just going to talk about the weird foods we eat, or do we have a game
plan? Yeah, we're going to like call it up from memory and like give people the wrong recipes.
Yes. We're like, no, it's true. If you lick the bottom of your shoe, you'll taste bananas.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Or you smoke your shoe, and it's just like smoking a banana.
Gets you just as high, right.
So we put a call out onto the Twitter asking people to send in some questions, and we got a big response. I'm going to start off with right off the top. We got a couple questions. I actually think Rabbit Badger wanted to know about, you're asking the wrong guys this one, but is the reason we can't detect dark matter or dark energy because it's moving backwards through time? Brian, answer.
Oh my God, that sounds awesome. What if, for all I know, this could be like a real theory. This is how little I know about dark energy. You know who we should get in is my daughter, Penelope. She watches all of, you know, she watched The Elegant Universe like 20 times. She watches the Into the Wormhole with Morgan Freeman and the Stephen Hawking specials and everything. She probably knows more about this than I do.
Well, in dark matter and dark energy are two very, very, very different things. So we should clarify that. And they both, they're detected, they appear in the equation, so to speak. And dark matter is sort of what seems to be holding up the universe, why things stick together. And we can't see it, but it's out there. And that could mean anything from just a bunch of elementary particles that we just don't observe to, you know, the universe could be just filled with just dark, massive objects we don't know. Or as I like to believe, perhaps, like, forget, like, you know, these big, like, Dyson spheres and space elevators and all of our primitive ideas on, like, massive galactic-level construction. What if it's just, like, some giant galactic machine built by aliens?
That would be rad. Now, if I remember correctly, dark matter, the reason it's proposed is because, like, galaxies don't spin at the right speed for they would expect motion if there was much, much more mass.
Yes.
In there, right? But we don't see any more mass.
Again, and we are two idiots trying to answer this question, so right. There are far more qualified people out there going to be like, no, guys, that's not it at all. But they are very, very different concepts.
Now,
it's like
dark energy. What about dark energy? I don't know where that one pops up in the...
I think that's like an equation balancing thing. When you sit down and you look at, like, you know, the formation of the universe and then what happens, there's supposed to be this abundant amount of dark energy. That might be, or that's the repulsive force or something.
I'll tell you who the repulsive force is. It's a certain Sasquatch-looking co-host of the Weird Things podcast.
I don't know who you're talking about. It's all pure Tang to me.
Yes.
So here's a cool question from Derek wants to know. He says, what would happen if an infinite power source was discovered, but only one can exist?
Only one infinite power source can exist.
So imagine we find in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, like, some unobtainium geyser or something like that. It can produce all of the energy we can, but the problem is there's only one source of it.
I mean, what does it matter? You got an infinite amount of it. I mean, it's
who has it, Bri?
Well... It does. Whoever has it right now is not going to have it for a very long time. That's for damn sure.
I mean, so what happened? What's the consequences of
that? Well, the consequence is either he gets it out at a fair way that makes everyone happy, or he holds on to too much of it and revolution occurs, and then it's swiped away to, you know, maybe you get a succession of people who sit like king of the throne for a few minutes until finally, you know, someone works out a program by which we all get it. It's infinite. It's infinite.
So are we saying, like, warfare?
Oh, yeah. There's definitely going to be warfare. There's definitely going to be a lot of fighting. But eventually, it'll get better over time, and then there'll be better distribution.
So when you have an infinite source of energy, and let's assume that it's non-polluting, doesn't raise – you know, the problem is any source of energy is going to raise – the thermal temperature of the planet, pretty much, because whatever energy we're not radiating out into space, we're keeping here. Either we use that to form complex hydrocarbons that we can then lock that energy up,
right?
Or, you know, we're using it in some other source. That's a funny thing about energy, and that's one of the ways you would spot perhaps an intelligent species from space.
I guess here's the other question too: is something can be infinite in, you know, because like the sun is for all practical purposes in our lifetimes an infinite source of energy. It's just not a lot of energy.
Well, we'll assume the throughput is huge.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Gotcha.
So, but you think about, you know, one of the things that was a big boom, Iceland. Part of the reason why Iceland is now in this economic collapse that it is in right now is they went through a boom, and the boom came from because they realized they had all this geothermal energy and they had a very tiny population.
Yeah.
But with all that geothermal energy, they said, oh, wow, you know, we can do things that are much more energy intensive than other countries. For instance, metallurgy, like steel manufacturing.
Desalination. I don't know why they would have to. They got all that ice.
What's that?
I was thinking of, like, the first thing I thought of was desalination, but then I realized they wouldn't have to because they're sitting on all that fresh water.
And no money in that, but because the shipping's everything. But what they did is they did, like, steel processing and metallurgical stuff because it takes a lot of energy to do that. And so they could start build up these plants, and that cheaper energy gave – and that's one of the things it's – we talk a lot about, like, hey, let's just carbon tax or do stuff like that, but it's the 2% difference in the price of steel – can make all the world's difference in an economy. And when you raise energy prices, things get crazy. So Iceland had this sort of boom because, hey, look, we got cheap energy. And then all of a sudden the investment boom that followed, and then the overcapitalization, and then the everything sort of falls apart after that because they realized that they were much more like many, many booms based upon a potential, you know, hey, this is going to be great. Like we saw, you know, the internet. You know, the internet's still around. It's still functional. But
Right. But the boom, we finally have evened out the speculation to return on investment.
Yeah.
At this point.
And that's kind of a problem that Chinese investment is sort of facing, is that we're hopeful economists like the idea of China being this growing economy for the next 30 years with this growing middle class. But already we're seeing the signs there of they're trying to freeze loans and trying to control the expansion, because the problem is like they've like overinvested a ton in real estate that's sitting empty. There are factories that are probably running, that are not running right now. And we look at satellite imagery and we can tell this, and it's a scary thing. So,
has there in the past been advancements where essentially people thought that they had run across a truly infinite source of energy? I mean, or has everything been incremental? Like, I know that there was intense euphoria about the potential of atomic energy shortly after, or maybe even before World War II. Is it a case where every time a new energy source has been tapped into that we overstate the possibility with it?
I think there's perhaps, but the other side of it is that we tend to magnify the side effects.
Yeah.
And you take natural gas, okay, and fracking. Fracking's an incredible technology. You know, just 10 years ago, we weren't even sure if it was practical. Now, we have abundant amounts of natural gas in the United States, which has actually lowered our carbon footprint below what would have been if we had agreed to certain environmental accords.
Really?
Oh, yeah. If you look at the natural gas production, what it's been able to offset, because natural gas has less carbon in it than oil does. So when you split that, when you use that in combustion, you put less carbon in the atmosphere. So natural gas, 5, 6, 7 years ago, the environmentalists were like, yeah, natural gas is great. Then we found a ton of natural gas, and then we get, you know, the anti-fracking lobby, which, you know, we need to be observing these things. But, you know, documentaries that have come out have just outright lied to people about what the real dangers are.
Okay, so now, and I know nothing about why I should be upset with fracking, but man, do certain people just really hate fracking just on the surface of it. The only thing I've seen has been, I saw the preview for some anti-fracking documentary where they lit like tap water on fire. Yes. And then said, fracking's bad, but then later I heard that had nothing to do with fracking whatsoever.
Right.
And a lot of communities have flammable, you know, or natural gas seeping into the, like, walk me through this.
So yeah, that's one of the things that people say, look at this tap water on fire, which that's ground
visual
level.
Oh man, but you got to admit, man, that's documentary money in the bank.
it's hysteria. Look at this, it's on fire. And
that
has to do with ground level methane, which, and the thing is if the methane was that freely available in large quantities, you wouldn't have to frack. Goes way, way, way below into the surface of the earth to go in there and to get the natural gas. That has to do with surface level natural gas. And the instances they've shown there were places you could get that was naturally a naturally occurring phenomenon.
Hmm.
But you find that in places where you go look for natural gas that you're going to use fracking for. So
right. You
have this people making this incorrect causation and correlation there. And there is issues that you want to be careful of anytime you do any major industrial procedure, ground level contamination, et cetera. These are things that we don't just say, la, 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 it's fine, but we get this hysteria and we get worked up about a lot of things that,
I guess,
unfortunately.
I guess, how much of the discussion do you think is aesthetics based? Because on the surface, setting off bombs underneath, miles underneath ground just doesn't seem like the best idea in the world.
Well, no, it's using high pressure steam.
Okay, whatever. but essentially, just breaking.
How about magma, Brian? Should we stop magma?
Yes, we must stop before it melts again. Magma.
I mean, all these things we need to have a reasoned and balanced look at, and that's the problem. Is you get a lot of hysteria about it, where people assume there is this religious sort of aesthetic idea on one hand that anything we do is bad, and the other hand too is that we can't do anything to harm our planet. Which, in the long run, I think it's hard for us to, because our planet can spit us out anytime it wants and has.
Sure.
So, but anyway, I think there always are these trade-offs. Wind power on one hand it's neat, you have a thing and it just runs and it spins, but then you start thinking, where do you put all these wind machines?
Now, if I understand correctly, there are two big things that need to be cracked in order for us to really dive in on both, I guess, both solar and wind, one of which is we still have a long way to go on battery power, right? Like our batteries are terribly inefficient. They're they're filled with, you know, horrific chemicals that, you know, that get leaked, and then they don't even hold on to the electricity long enough. And then I guess also there's significant power losses because we don't have superconductors that we're able to use to get everything from point A to point B.
Like, and solar and wind, like, you know, wind, like, oh, wind runs 24 hours, but sometimes it's at 3% output, sometimes 100%. So you still have to build a power plant to supply your power no matter what. It's not going to be running as much, but these methane power plants, you know, are actually relatively clean compared to everything else, are actually pretty good. But the problem you get into is, you know, one of the reasons we got upset with coal was, even if you have, let's say, clean coal, like you talk about mountaintop strip mining, okay, where you take away an entire, you have a mountain, beautiful mountain range, you strip away the entire thing and nothing's left there.
Right.
Well, that's an aesthetic argument. And then that you can make that argument against, well, do we need to be covering up these ecosystems in the desert with large amounts of solar arrays? And, you know, is that any better or worse? And that comes down to a personal
choice. I like the nuttier ideas, the ideas about stuff like setting up a giant solar arrays in space with football field sized panels that then beam down the energy in the form of microwave radiation into a spot in the desert.
I'm going to go one step further.
Go ahead.
Antimatter harvesting.
What, now, where would we get antimatter harvesting? Because I know right now where we get it is from super colliders, right? Or I'm sorry, super colliders? Yeah, super colliders.
So the way we can manufacture right now is we just take some particles, we smash them against each other, and we try to produce some antimatter. And you know, you'll hear these statistics about how much antimatter it would take to do X, Y, or Z, and how little we produce, but there's actually a Moore's law to antimatter production and containment.
No kidding.
If you look at what we're able to produce now, what we did 10 years ago or 5 years ago, it's like it doubles or something every 3 years.
Dude, antimatter is like a real thing. I love it because it's like growing up, it was so very comic booky, you know, it was so over the top. But just to have it be a real and important resource is awesome.
Well, and that's if we produce it ourselves, which takes a ridiculous amount of energy. But then if you look at the Earth, there's a satellite project to try and capture antimatter because it comes streaming off the sun. It gets shaped and channeled by the Earth's magnetic field. And so theoretically, there are points where you should be able to get more antimatter. If you go in the orbits of, let's say, Jupiter, like around Jupiter, you know, Jupiter's own magnetic field and the stuff coming off of the sun, you might have these kind of Lagrange points, of places where you could capture a lot of it.
That's amazing. Okay, so what about, is it helium-3 that was supposed to be on the moon that was supposed to be a valuable resource? What's so great about helium-3? And is it and is it still the buzzworthy thing where we think it's worth it to go through the incredible expense to get up to the moon?
Helium-3 is great for fusion. And so when you want to have a self-sustaining fusion reaction, you need to be able to supply fuel to it. And so helium-3 is useful for that.
All right. The best part is probably what the next big thing will be. Nobody here is even thinking or talking about, you know?
Well, you know, there's things that we're doing now that we'll be able to do better. That's a big thing. And then there's the trend in energy is that the next fuel is the one you have now, but you go, that's too expensive to harvest. That's really the way it comes down to. Like, oh, you know, we're using wood, we're cutting down trees to burn in our fireplaces. What about coal? Well, I got to have a metal axe to go get that coal. I got to get a bunch of guys together to go get it. And then with coal, we started finding, like, you know, when we wanted to go deeper, it was harder than, like, in Scotland, which was a big coal producing area. Well, we want to go coal, but we got to go under the ocean and it keeps filling with water. Technically, it's too hard. And that's where the steam engine came about, was to actually pump the water out of there.
Huh.
And that's always been the trend, is that we know what the next thing is, but everybody dismisses it as it's too expensive. You know, oil. Well, you got to pump it out of the ground. And we don't have the capabilities to do that. And then, well, now it's, we pump oil out of the ground and now we go deeper, and then natural gas, fracking, et cetera. And then we each time we move on to one of these new forms of fuel, what people tend to forget is they each get cleaner because we go towards more efficient forms where you have, you know, it's the real energy is in those hydrogen bonds. And the more you get into a more hydrogen rich fuel, the more energy you get, to ultimately we're going to get to the point where we'll probably, you know, be running things on hydrogen.
Yeah, there was in one of the presentations that he gave before he died, Michael Crichton was lamenting the fact that essentially politicians were legislating what science was doing anyway. And to illustrate his point, he showed a molecule of wood, which if you look at it, you know, it's a ton of carbon and just a few hydrogens all around on the sides. And then he, you know, put the oil, which was much more efficient. You know, you got a straight chain of carbon atoms with hydrogens on the side. And then he showed natural gas, which is even, it's nothing but hydrogens with a few carbons in there. And then we're eventually moving all the way to a pure hydrogen economy.
Yeah. And the problem is we've got people ask questions like, why don't we just spend the money to make that jump? And the problem is that science and innovation is not linear. Mm-hmm. It is not, you say X amount of, we'll spend X amount of dollars and we will get this solution.
You're not buying examples from a menu.
Like, what's that?
I said, you're not buying from a menu. Like, you know, it's not a case where you're like, well, if we spend $1,000 more, then we suddenly get this ability.
You hear like, oh, we need the Manhattan Project, right, of energy. Now, an often mostly overlooked part of history that people forget about the Manhattan Project, and there's a great book which covers it called Tuxedo Park. Do you know who, have we ever talked about Alfred E. Loomis? I think we may have mentioned him before.
No, not that I remember.
Alfred E. Loomis was, back around the turn of the century, the way you made a ton of money was you got involved in building power companies. That was the big IPO thing of its day. So you go to Chicago, you would get some investors together, and you're going to put together Chicago Power and Light. And you get the capital, you build your plants, you start supplying electricity. Because you think about electricity back in the turn of the century, the 19th century, electricity is something that you pump through wires, you put a meter on somebody's place, the cash register is in everybody's house or in the factories initially. You electrify factories and you make this, you know, make them able to, you know, function the way they could before. You get away from coal or whatever. It's an amazing money-making opportunity. So these power utilities were formed all around the country, all around the world. Westinghouse was big on that. Edison was big on that. And one of Westinghouse's partners was a guy named Alfred E. Loomis. He was originally was an attorney, was a hobbyist, inventor, scientist, physicist, and made tons of money through creating. He was a partner in a number of these electric utilities, got all of his money out of the stock market before it crashed, and probably was the richest man in America.
Wow. Okay?
Very private guy, very secretive guy. Wasn't a guy that was in newspapers, wasn't a guy like a lot of the other famous people we know about from that period of time. He was a very kept his stuff on the down low. Loved physics and lived in Tuxedo Park in New York and used to invite the world's leading physicists to come to his house and basically to tutor him and teach him about physics. As war looked like it was about to break out around World War II in the 1930s, you know, there was the talk about, how about harnessing the power of the atom, you know, atomic energy. And he began figuring out one of the big problems was, you know, the two problems he had to solve was, one, how do you create enough concentrated amount of uranium? So you had that problem. And then two was, how do you actually build the bomb itself? So a lot of the work he actually started in his living room. He brought these scientists in there and they started developing the mathematical equations and the groundworks for what would become the Manhattan Project, went to the government, said, hey, you guys need to be looking into this because I'm sure the Germans are looking into this. And the government said, no. Atomic, that's too science fiction. Not interested. Okay.
Wow.
War breaks out and he keeps putting his own money into it, bringing these brain trusts in there, the guys that went on to start the Manhattan Project. And he funded this privately. Then finally, War Department's like, you know what? Let's go look at this nuclear bomb thing again. And what started as the Manhattan Project actually began in this guy's living room.
That is amazing. I can't believe he got virtually no credit as being the person who started. I mean, were other people talking about it at that
time?
Well,
remember, it was total. Everything was declared total secrecy. Everything was total state secret at that point. And then the work that he was actually, I think, funding at MIT to be done there, everything got transported into the two different areas. You had Los Alamos and Livermore. Livermore was working on the processing. Los Alamos building the bomb itself. And it was total secrecy. So after the war ends, 1945, you know, we still don't know much about other than what the government wanted to tell us about these things. And this was Loomis was a private guy, had no interest in trying to publicize that. After they moved that project out, he started putting some time and money into trying to figure out how to get radar to work.
Wow. Because
the British were developing radar, which was a great invention. But between all the air raids, it got to be very difficult to continue that research. So Loomis worked on that. So we have these pieces of history we forget about, and like you said, it's not a thing you order off a menu, and you would not have had an atomic bomb in 1945 you know, which arguably ended the war, preventing us having to do a land invasion, et cetera. That's a whole nother discussion.
Sure, but anyhow, sure.
We wouldn't have had that when we had it if it wasn't for this individual.
Wow, that is amazing.
And so we don't know where these things come from.
All right. Do we have another question?
Yes, we do. Serious question here.
Good.
Who would win in a fight, a Minotaur or the creature from the Black Lagoon? And this is from Kneebones on Twitter.
Oh, dude, it's got to be a Minotaur. Are you kidding me? Like, I'm assuming it's a battle in an arena, right? Like, I'm picturing a gladiator arena. I mean, I guess it really just boils down to what the environment is, because obviously...
Because, like, I was with you first because I'm like, well, the Minotaur, because the Minotaur is kind of a magical creature, too.
Yeah.
But then I'm thinking, like, the creature of the Black Lagoon, he's like a holdover from millions of years ago. We don't know what he is.
But you see, when I think of the Minotaur, I actually think of the way it was represented in Time Bandits. Did you ever see Time Bandits?
I love Time Bandits.
Right?
And
And so Sean Connery is taking on the Minotaur.
There was a Time Bandits Minotaur at Dragon Con, by the way.
No, there was not.
Yes, there was.
Oh, that's amazing. Dude, that was awesome. Minotaur, I think of it that way, but that guy was a badass, except he got beat by a man. I just don't have a lot of love or respect for the creature from the Black Lagoon.
That's the problem. That's why he's an outcast, Bri.
Yeah, kind of a sucky, he's like a sulky, sucky, suck character who sucks.
Oh, it's rough. That was like, I remember years ago they did a 3D movie. They showed the original version of it in 3D, and you go to your local Pantry Pride or whatever to pick you up your song.
I watched it in 1982. I remember watching it on television in Littleton, Colorado, and I remember the novelty of 3D was kind of cool, but I was not impressed with what a badass the creature for the Black Lagoon was.
Misunderstood. I think they shot that not too far from where I live.
Really?
Yeah.
It was like, by which you mean your own backyard.
He could come in here anytime, Brian, and take vengeance on me for the things you said.
There you go. People say I look like him. What do you think?
When was the last recorded case of ape rape?
I think it's happening right now. I think all ape. I mean, how do you measure consent with animal sex?
Well, that's like they talk about like the bonobos and like, oh, those they're like the best chimps. They're always making love and this. Like, I wonder like how much of it's really consensual.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. But it's like they've got cases of trading sex for favors and for stuff.
Exploitation. For
yeah. Huh. Not bad. Seems legit.
All right. Good one from Toucan Monkey. Here's a time we'll insert a sponsor message.
Hey, y'all. Big Bad Con is a role-playing game convention being held in the Oakland Airport Hilton on October 5th through the 7th. Over 120 tabletop and LARP events. Plus, guest Luke Crane, the creator of the Mouse Guard RPG. He's going to be in the house. Check it out. Thank you to Sean Hayworth for buying this ad. Remember, you can buy an ad here on Weird Things Podcast. Just head on over to weirdthings.com/sponsor.
All right, done.
All right.
Justin listens to this. What's his face? Toucan Monkey wants to know, have you thought you've seen a UFO? Seen anything paranormal before?
The problem is, when I did, I was a kid, you know, and kids are prone to convincing themselves of what they would see. I didn't really have patience to really look for a lot of that stuff because you had to do a lot of waiting if you wanted to find a ghost or a lot of waiting. You just got to wait for something to happen, right? Whereas psychic powers, though, man, I was crazy into psychic powers because you could just keep doing tests. And if you didn't get a hit, then you could just, you know, hey, let's do another test. Maybe you weren't like flexing. Just try getting all tightened up and then do it again. Like, now I got powers.
Yeah, I remember doing that, like keep doing the test enough time until I got an above average success rate.
Yeah, totally. And be like, well, now it's true.
Well, I've seen, I have two UFO stories.
All right.
Three UFO stories.
Wait. So, okay, go ahead.
First one, when I was a kid, it's a hazy memory, when my family was moving from Oregon to Florida. And I remember like sitting in the backseat of the car, we're driving through like Texas or some other place like that. And out in the desert, whatever, I saw something that looked like it was orb, silver sort of thing floating, whatever. could have been anything. Could have been a balloon. I could have been hallucinating. Could have been dreaming. Could have been anything. I just remember seeing this and wanting to say to my parents, like, stop, let's look. What is that? You know, but I couldn't. And when you look at how a lot of UFO stories and abductee stories are, you realize it's like the perfect setup for, and then we had missing time, and then yeah, I had strange markings.
Well, and that's the thing that that drives me nuts is, you know, the whole missing time thing. It's all after the fact. It seems like nobody comes up and says, 5 minutes ago, I just was kidnapped by aliens. Yeah. Instead, it's like, you know, it's always like, well, you know, I was thinking back to weeks ago, and I remember this missing time, and then I went to a hypnotherapist, and now I seem to remember that I got diddled by an alien.
Yeah, I have that missing time from like 2003 to 2005.
Yeah.
Probably about 2 or 3 years there.
You know what? I guess the only experience I've had that was UFO-ish was it was at a party where people were like, what is up with that star? It's moving up and down and side to side. And it was a really convincing visual illusion until you figure out that essentially it's that you're using the canopy of the trees as your frame of reference. And as they slowly shift in the wind, not enough that you can really tell, but it's like, you know, it ends up, it really does look like, especially if you got a bright planet like Saturn or something up there, it really looks like it's just dancing up and down, moving around.
Very true. Second time I was driving between here and Orlando, South Florida and Orlando, and I saw off to the side, I saw this, it's nighttime on the highway, I'm on the turnpike driving, and I see this like bright row of lights just moving at a very, very slow level, very, very bright low level of lights. I'm like, well, that's weird. Stop the car. I get out and I look and I wait. And I wait, and I see it's moving slower than an airplane would move, slower than an airplane would move. Bright row of lights, it keeps moving, it's moving, and then I hear the hum, and it gets closer and closer. If I was further out to the west, I may not have had the answer that I had, and I would have this interesting story about seeing this, about, oh, it moved, it couldn't have been an airplane, couldn't have been that.
Well, so what was it?
Take a guess.
I mean, like a blimp or something? It was?
It was a Goodyear blimp.
You know what's funny? That was my other story from when I was a kid. Like the Goodyear blimp used to, or one of the Goodyear blimps used to come around near where we lived in North Houston back in the day. And I remember it blowing my mind at the time. That's awesome. Yeah.
And if you think about it, if it goes on a path that doesn't come close enough, you'll just see this thing out in the distance, and then you're going to, UFO.
I'll tell you what else, and this isn't a UFO thing, but I remember driving along and just looking to my right, and there on the horizon I saw a full-on nuclear explosion, just this dome of orange flame of what was obviously a city being detonated all at once. And I remember shouting.
And that's when we were kids. That's what we were afraid of.
But this is like, man, it must have been 15 years ago. And I remember just driving along, and I pointed, I was just like, holy S, holy effing S. And the guy looked, and because he saw me freaking out at something, his context are what horrible things happening over there. So he turns and sees the orange fireball. And then it took us a second to realize it was the moon, you know, rising. But like for that brief second to be convinced that you're witnessing the end of the world was pretty amazing. Yeah, exactly. It's like, this is it. Kiss me.
Third time with Mary. You know Mary.
Yeah, sure. Mary Jarris.
We're driving to San Diego. We're going to go to the zoo, and we're driving through the hills. Love San Diego. Going through the hills there. Very, very pretty. I look out, and I see a silver ball floating. Big silver ball. It's floating over near the top of a mountain or the hill. I'm looking at this. We keep heading towards it. I'm like, it's UFO? And it clearly can see the silver ball floating.
Sure.
Big, huge silver ball. I'm like, it's the alien ship. It's here. It's finally. Silver ball makes sense. Forget that saucer. This is what they look like. We're driving. It's one of those things like, I'm like, I can't wait to find out what that is because I know there's a great explanation.
Wait a minute. I just realized that I had one just earlier this year. That was like a 30-minute long extravaganza. Finish yours, and I'll tell you mine. Keep going.
We're like, it's like 20 minutes driving, and it's still towards where we're headed. I'm like, all right, let's be curious, find out what this is. And I had one of those things, like, and that's a thing that I always would get on other people's case as a skeptic, is you don't know what you don't know.
Right.
And I get people like, oh, UFO stories or ghost stories, like, oh, and we know this, and there's no way the child could have learned this song or this. Like, you don't know what you don't know. I don't know. And I'm looking at this, I'm going like, I don't know what this is. I am sure there's a very reasonable explanation for it, so I'm kind of excited to see what this is going to be.
Sure.
Because I didn't know they had these. And this was, and once I saw them, I'm like, oh, wow, that's really awesome. And now everybody else, you know, listening knows about these, but I didn't at the time, and it was one of these balloons, these permanent helium balloons that's tethered, and they have it at the San Diego Wildlife Park, and you can go, they have a big big gondola you can stand on underneath, and then a cable lets it up like 100 feet or so up into the air so you can see the whole park. So there's one in Vegas, I think there's one in Miami, and it's just this neat attraction they build now, and the balloon is this big, this was like a big silver-looking sphere. So it's a permanent tethered helium balloon that you can use to go for sightseeing.
I don't think I've seen that outside of maybe – I know there's something similar to what you're describing, like out at one of the Disney parks that you always see.
Yep.
But to have a giant – you said it was a giant silver ball just floating there. So when we came back from the airport a few months ago, looked up, and there's just a floating rectangle. Just a floating rectangle with no – and the first thing you think is like, well, it's probably maybe a message hanging from the back of a plane. You know, it's flying around. You got banners or whatever. But the problem is you can't see any plane, and it's not moving. And it was probably 30 minutes before we were able to discern that it actually was exactly what we originally thought it was. But it's funny because you first think, oh, it's got to be a sign dangling from a plane. But then you go through all the reasons why that can't be. Well, it's like, well, there's no plane. I don't see it moving. But then later you begin to realize, like, well, the reason I don't see it moving is because I'm moving. And, you know, my perspective is shifting. And there's the only thing I have is the background of the clouds, which, you know, maybe it could be changing or whatever. But that was a pretty good curiosity as well.
Oh, it's like if you look at. When we tend to think about things in the abstract, we often have this sort of very straight-on kind of view, like you'd see in a children's book, a side view of an airplane. Very few people, if you ask them to draw an airplane, will draw an airplane straight on.
Yes.
And if you look at an airplane straight on,
looks like a UFO.
Yeah, you get this big, and you think about out in the desert or places where people would often get these airplane sightings, or if you're on a path where the airplane's coming straight towards you for a considerable amount of time. And, you know, you talked about before the motion effect. If you've got tree branches or things like that swaying in the wind, you get a lot of erratic motion. And it's very, very hard to kind of talk people out of things once they've seen them. And you know, not to say it doesn't mean there aren't UFOs and things going on, but there's just a humongous amount of explanations for why we see weird stuff, but people want to pretend it's not just what it is.
I guess I got one more. Wow, for thinking I didn't have any, I guess I have another one. The other one was turning away
these repressed memories
on the horizon. This perfect glowing disc, like just bright as can be, bright as the sun, just floating in place over there. And that must have been for a good minute that it looked exactly like that until finally the plane banked. It was like a, you know, American Airlines, their fuselage is all silver, mm-hmm. so it's highly reflective. And the sun was setting behind me, and it was just at that right angle where you got this perfect band of brightness, and the brightness was so bright, obviously, that you weren't able to see any of the other features of the plane.
It's amazing just how simple things can confuse us.
Yep.
So here's a question from Iago Voss. I presume that's how you pronounce it. My question for Weird Things. What animal would make the best zombie virus vector and why?
Like a kitten, right? Because even if you saw a kitten nestling up to like a corpse of a dead person, you'd be all like, oh, poor kitty, he doesn't know his master's dead. And you pick up the kitty and then you're infected.
Slow moving vector though, Brian.
Yeah, okay. You're thinking like birds or bugs or...
Yeah, like bird, like... That's why there was such like a bird flu panic, because like birds can fly, you know, and they can spread it. You know, mosquitoes tend to be very localized, and you can spray and you can get rid of them. So
yeah, but I'm trying to think of what would make it, because if the virus specifically is about,
I mean, I like your kitten zombies. That's not a bad idea, but
yeah,
if you're trying,
like, I'm trying to figure out like what would make it perfect for zombies, because You know, yeah, I don't know if birds would work because you can't have shambling zombie flying things.
Well, are we just talking? We just need a vector. So maybe they could be just a carrier.
All right. I guess birds.
I like that. The birds, the feathers falling out, and it's trying to fly.
Yeah, peck your eyes out. I don't know. I could think, what about, are there ever disease vectors with, like, fish?
I'm sure among fish, as far as fish to human, the only thing I would even possibly think is you might get some sort of prion thing that might be able to jump the grade on that, but, it's a salmonella.
Yeah. All right.
There's some things, so.
All right. Well, if I'm going to pick one creature to bring the apocalypse, I'm leaning towards zombie kitten, but I'm going to say realistically, you know what? Zombie squirrels. With their eyes are all white.
They're always shifty. Cute. You know, squirrels, I don't trust squirrels.
They're able to leap really far, and they're always in your food.
It's all right. I like your squirrels. Let me think about this for a second. The problem with the plague was you had it was like the fleas. And fleas are great. I mean, fleas just like, you know, they just
great.
You get some fleas are specific to certain plants, but you can get fleas that just sort of kind of go wherever they want and spread like crazy because, you know, flea can get on a rat, can get on a mouse, can get on a cat, get in your bed.
Get on you? Get in your hair? Yeah.
So, yeah, my vector, fleas.
Fleas? Fleas or bed bugs?
Yeah, fleas.
You're like, fleas, please, come on.
Please, please.
Fleas, please.
All right, so we've got another one in here. Rye wants to know, can zombies be racist?
They can't think. You got to have, like, a preference of things. I mean, I guess they could be racist if in their behavior they avoided, like, Puerto Ricans or, you know, or the Irish or whatever. That's a good question. I guess you could just see.
I don't think they're self-aware. If they were self-aware, then it would be wrong to kill them.
Okay, so here's the thing. What if they're not self-aware, but what if they never will eat the meat of only a certain race? Would that make them racist?
Yeah, but I mean, you have diseases that afflict one race more than another. Does that mean the disease is racist?
Yes, they are. They are racist diseases. Yes, that's sickle cell anemia is a racist disease.
Interesting. All right, let's go to another question. This one actually came in earlier. This was a good one. I think they asked us before via email. SonicPet7 says, would you rather never sleep or actively use your excess brain power to learn or problem solve in your sleep?
I already have a hard time falling asleep, and I hate not sleeping. I hate being off schedule with everyone else. I hate laying in bed awake, so I'll do the second one. Like, go to sleep and then, like, program what I'm going to learn while I'm asleep.
Yeah, I thought about that. Do I want to give up sleep or not? And part of the thing is the more we learn about sleep and how it actually, it's not just, there's a lot, we have this headlines came out this week, which is like in 6-7 years ago, we had the same sort of headlines, which is sort of like, hey, junk DNA, not junk DNA after all, which I thought we kind of already figured that it probably did something, but there was a new round of research to say, yeah, no, really, that DNA is doing something, but
right.
I don't think we've really thought that it was junk DNA for over 10 years. But sleep, you know, the idea of sleep does something, because you think about it, and does something important, because otherwise sleep makes us, we're extremely vulnerable, mm-hmm. very, very vulnerable when we sleep. You think about this, you're going to take an organism and put it in such a state that, you know, for a third to half of its life, it is going to be totally prone and vulnerable to something and coming along and gobbling it up. So it must do something critical. And different animals have evolved different forms of sleep. They say that dolphins can maybe sleep with one part of the brain on, the other part of it off. I've heard some skeptical stuff of that, but when you're in the ocean and a predator can come at you from any point, dolphins don't like hop into caves. Then that might explain why they tend to be more in groups, et cetera. You know, one of the reasons, you know, how mammals cope when they're out there in that environment.
Essentially taking shifts on watch.
Yeah. Other animals have like a really quick, like startup, you know, they're in a sort of a sleep state, then boom, you know, they're awake and they don't have to be like us and get a cup of coffee. I think that sleep for humans is our brain. Like there's this verbal part of us, which is so much a part of our consciousness. It's why children who don't learn how to speak after a certain point never develop certain kinds of cognition.
Right.
You can't, like feral children, you can't teach them to speak after a certain point. And I think it's because you need speech and that inner, I mean, thinking for me is just the voice inside my head talking to myself. Same for you?
Sometimes. Like there's a lot of times. There's a lot of times that I think in pictures, like I, you know, earlier today, there was some actor that I could think of his face. I could picture everything he was in, but I couldn't think of his name or any of that. I mean, I think there's certainly examples of thoughts that have nothing to do with language.
Oh, no, I agree. I mean, I'm a, you know, as a magic inventor, a lot of what I do is not even verbal in that sense. It's just visual. What I'm saying is that a lot of like opinions and things like this on stuff come from sort of this sort of verbal part of the brain kind of way. I guess what I'm getting at is that so much of who we are may be formed in our sleep. That yes. To lose that well, might be bad.
We've talked about this as well before. I think one of my picks previously was the Nova documentary on the science of sleep, which is available on Netflix Instant Streaming. And one of the tests that they showed is seemed to indicate that one of the things that you do during sleep is you run simulations. You practice handling problems. You run projections of what you know. Obviously, dreaming is a tremendously important part of sleep. Man, sleep is a real mystery. It's so amazing.
Yeah. So the NSFW alcohol asks, how many times a week do you drink?
That's what drink liquids in general, like water. Sure, every day. The answer is every day.
Water. The answer is same for me.
Have you thought about can we talk real quick? Because you're really interesting in that you don't drink, right?
No.
And you ever think about like trying it?
All the time. yeah, it's funny. I read an article or something that talked about like how it's like in L.A. or places like that, if you say you don't drink, they assume it's because you're a recovering alcoholic or something.
Oh, that's funny.
Which I thought was kind of – that's funny. Like, not really funny, but like, yeah, I never it's a boring story, but I first started working on cruise ships as a teenager, and people were under the impression that I was older because maybe I told them that I was older so I could get the work.
Sure.
And my first day on a cruise ship, I go into – I'm invited to a party that's in a cabin. A bunch of the divers are having a party and the dancers are there. And one of the divers is holding this beautiful girl in his arms and they're doing body shots out of her belly button. They go, Andrew, try. And I'm only like 18 years old. And in our industry, there is a very, very high incidence of, in entertainment in general, of alcoholism.
Sure.
It has a lot of things. The kind of people, one, are attracted to it. And then when you work in bars, particularly like if you're working in a cruise ship, you're working on a bar, you live in a bar.
Well, and I made sometimes the decision that's part of your compensation. That's part of the perk of getting to get on stage is that you get to drink free for the rest of the night. And you have this vicious cycle that encourages you to maximize your benefit from this gig.
And I've seen that with people. And I made this decision as a teenager. So let me make this an easy problem to solve. I'm just not going to drink yet. I'll wait until I'm 21, all right? So I'm 18 on a cruise ship. I hit 21, and I look at the number of people I knew who had problems. And the problem with alcohol is it's a slippery slope. If somebody can be kind of like every now and then can a social get a little bit sloppy drunk or whatever and then be high-functioning the next day and not really think that they have a problem. And the problem for some people is it's when you get that sloppy drunk at the wrong time, it can F things up. And I've seen that happen to entertainers, a number of entertainers who I think are great people have had substance abuse problems. So I hit 21. I'm like, I'm still not going to drink. I'm not going to do anything. And you and I were libertarians and we're thinking like, hey, do whatever you want.
Sure.
But, and then I had people like, oh, I was like you, but you know, I did. And then I still haven't to this day. I have no problem with it. And I kind of, at some point, like, you know, I could see myself, you know, with a girlfriend or woman to be my wife or whatever, going through Europe and going to vineyards or something like that and trying wine or whatever, I'm open to it. I just haven't run
into that situation yet.
No, I kind of look at it like tattoos. My friends who seem to be the most prone towards tattoos are the ones that at least have their lives figured out. And they're ready to make this permanent decision. You know, they're 22 years old and, you know, they're going to get, you know, they're going to get Elvish tattooed on their leg. And it's like,
you don't even know what you want to do
for a job next year.
Yeah, sure.
No. And so I think for me, it's like, you know, before I put something, I'm a control freak, so I'm different.
Really?
I know. No, it's
like, well, it is funny, too. It's like it's weird to be the kind of person who, you know, and I find myself in these discussions all the time. I don't ever want to do heroin, but I want heroin to be legal because somewhere out there is somebody who, you know, is treating their body like they own themselves. And it's just it's a very weird position to say I want people to be free to do something nutty, but I don't want to actually, you know, like I think I would never, ever drive anywhere without buckling my seatbelt. Mm-hmm. But I oppose there being a law requiring people
the difference for me on that is like, well, when we look at public highways as a public corporation, we all have a stake. And if you have a big ranch and you want to drive without your seatbelt, I'm like, go for it.
Yeah.
But if you getting rear-ended by a guy means that you're going to lose control of your vehicle because you don't have a seatbelt and you're going to hit me when I'm minding my own business in the next lane and we're on a highway we all own, then yeah. It's a different sort of approach for me.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Huh. Do you want to take another pause?
Yes. Now for a commercial message from
an important viewer like you.
Yes.
This one comes in from Richard Thames. Like the river in England. Maybe it's Thames here in America. I don't know. Either way, Richard's in a contest that ends on the 19th of September. And he'll win big, as long as he's not last. So go ahead and vote for Richard T. in the family category. It's a contest for the Navy Federal Credit Union. And you can find it very, very easily. Go to bit.ly/voteRichard. Very easy. Go to bit.ly/voteRichard and vote for him in the family category.
Well, take that to heart, kids. That's a very important message to remember.
It turns out that it's just something hateful. It turns out Justin bought that spot for himself and just went on a 30-minute rant about how much he hates us for doing the show without him.
All right, so we've got a few more here. A lot more, actually. Got away, says.
I'll tell you what, this last section, since we got 10 more minutes before we're supposed to switch over to picks, why don't we do like lightning round and all the rest of these?
I'll do that. Gottawag wants to know, Andrew Main Stories podcast. Yes, I just haven't uploaded the Martian Emperor. Okay.
I say no.
Brian says no. Stacey B says, where do you both see yourselves in 10 years?
Oh, what a great question. I'll tell you what. Can we flip this? Can I say where I see you in 10 years?
Sure.
I'll tell you what, man. I've known you for what, 5-6 years now, and I've never seen you I've seen you try a lot of interesting things. I've never seen like a glove in a hand or a hand in a glove with you and the ebook publishing. I think that your stories are I think you will be a nationally famous author within 5 years and you'll be known for your movies in 10. I'm so excited to watch your career.
Thank you. We'll see. I'm interested in all media, and so we'll see. But yeah, I love that. Yeah, I'm very, very thrilled. Thank you for that. You know, it's amazing watching, like last night, Angel Killer hit number 11 in the United Kingdom.
And it keeps going up. Like at this point, it's no longer the fact that you got a bump from some email or something.
I'm being blocked by number 10 by some book called 50 Shades of Grey. I don't know what it is.
Welcome to my nightmare.
So Brian in 10 years, Brian's going to have 7 daughters.
Yes. I'm going to keep making the lady babies.
What I'd like to see Brian is Brian's on-air personality. I'd like to see it in different mediums. So I'd like to see Brian not do one or the other, but continue the podcasting. I'd like to see Brian on television in some form. and probably not like an O.J. Simpson trial thing.
You know what? I'll take what I can get.
Yeah, get it. So,
there's no such thing as bad publicity.
10 years goes by really fast.
Yeah, it really does.
You know, a lot can happen.
And I'll tell you what, here's another thing, and I've said this many times. I truly believe that the closest thing that exists to real magic in my life is the power of writing down written goals. And you start off, you want to make these goals for 1 year increments or whatever, but at some point your career starts to hit a level where you got to start thinking in terms of 5-year goals and 10-year goals. So like 2 years ago, 3 years ago, when we bought this new house, I sat down and I just wrote outrageous 10-year goals about how, you know, about how many followers I wanted on Twitter, how many television appearances I wanted to have made over 10 years or whatever. And 3 years into it, I think out of the 10 things I wrote down, I know that I've written 3 of the 4 books I promised myself I was going to write. I know that that I've developed, you know, 2 of the 4 shows I promised myself I was going to develop. I know that it's amazing to see how what seems like an outrageous goal over a very long amount of time, once you write it down and think about it and take little actions every day towards it, how those things just happen what seems like overnight.
Well, I think that you hit the nail on the head for me with the actions thing, and that's always been a critical thing for me. And my goals are always very specific about the things that I need to do. And some people have wish lists, like, I wish this would happen, I wish that would happen. And you and I tend to be more focused on things we need to go out and go do, because the universe is going to work out the way it's going to. In order to have an impact, you've got to make a very big noise and really put a lot of energy into making things happen. And I've seen some things come into fruition. The groundwork were laid 5 years before, and I never thought I'd get there. And then all of a sudden, overnight, something happens. And you go, oh, wow, you know, this came out of nowhere. But the work was put in place, and that's it's all about the work.
All right, next question.
All right. Toucan says, if someone discovers that the center of the Earth has something amazing, who owns it?
Whoever gets there first and can extract it and monetize it. I mean, it's like it's the answer to that is the exactly what if something very valuable was found on the moon, or what if something very valuable was found orbiting Jupiter or whatever. I mean, man, for as much as we like to think our world is pretty much all the property is carved out and established and all the different countries own their piece of the pie, there's an awful lot that's just still there for the taking, and whoever gets it is going to have it.
Well, we look at, we talk about, with climate change, and, you know, we've had our planet has been coming out of an ice age for thousands of years, and things that were locked up in ice. You know, and it goes back and forth. We had a little ice age where a lot of glacier, a few hundred years where glaciers expanded and then they contracted and stuff. But Antarctica, was once a vast, huge continent filled with life. And there's oil in Antarctica. There's gold in Antarctica. There's plutonium. There's tons of mineral wealth inside of this continent.
Wow.
That were arguably, we're not going for there now because
international treaties.
And it's one of those things we talk about. We're running out of resources. Like, we've got an entire continent that we've done next to nothing. And there's like, well, it's under ice. That's a solvable problem.
Yeah. 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 I've got a lot of hair dryers, and they get very, very hot if you just hold them at the glaciers long enough.
We'll know that we're really in critical problems. Like, when we're really in, Brian and I are both sort of the same point of view about, you're not going to run out of anything, because as the price gets higher, you either find more of it or you find something to replace it with. But we know things will get really, really critical when we start talking about mining Antarctica.
When Operation Giant Hairdryer gets brought up on the congressional floor.
And that hasn't happened. And so that kind of tells you that, like, all right, so as far as our concerns about resources. So real fast, 8 a.m. Unicorn, can we talk about unicorns and how awesome are we?
Unicorns are pretty rad, but mainly because it's funny for me to be a man in his mid-30s talking about what traditionally is the domain of 8-year-old girls. That's the only reason I'm obsessed with unicorns. I need more unicorn and rainbow shirts, because the older and the uglier I get, the more funny it becomes to me.
I showed you the thing from the David Copperfield warehouse of Doug Henning's unicorn outfit.
Yes!
It's awesome. Amazing. I kind of think of myself as a unicorn. Kelly writes, I prefer to see you guys squirm under the topics. Money or love? Choose money. That's all you get and all that it offers. You don't ever experience love. Choose love. That's all you get. You struggle financially your whole life. What would you choose?
There's no question about it. It's got to be love. And I don't mean this in any kind of mushy kind of way, but it's instead in a purely pragmatic, what was it? Socrates was one of the first to point out that everything you want in life is a means to the end of happiness. Happiness is the only thing that you want for itself. You know, you want money. Why? So you can buy things. Why? So you can impress your friends. Why? Well, because that'll make me happy. You know, it's like happiness is always that end goal. And love is essentially synonymous with happiness, right? I guess as far as I'm thinking about it, I suppose there's love that's painful that just makes you want to kill yourself. But
great thing to say on National Suicide Awareness Day, Brian.
Is that today? I didn't know that. The next question.
Yeah, the only thing I would say that, like, I mean, for me, I'm like, oh, love, of course. Cause yeah, like you said, that's everything that sort of we go for. But the only thing I could say is like, man, though, if I had enough money and I could do something with that to benefit the world around me, so that if I died miserably, but, you know, I eliminated some form of pediatric cancer.
What would you lead a life of misery and hate every moment of it, but in your heart know that it was worth it because you improved the life of everyone on planet Earth for generations to come?
I would seriously consider it.
I would not. I would take love.
Really? No, I was like watching I think we talked about the movie that, like, there was Deep Impact or one of the other ones, and they're like, oh, you know, we might be able to save the Earth, but we're gonna have to die doing it. And they're all like, and I'm like, what an awesome way for your life to end.
Think about this all the time. I think about
90 peeing yourself, you know, 30 astronaut saving the planet.
See, I think about this. It's like someone is going to have to be the last generation on Earth, right? When everything ends, if you're in, also you're going to have to die sometime. So why not hope that you get to be part of the last generation? Like, if an asteroid is going to smash into Earth and end everything, kind of would like to be the guy who gets to watch it. So it's like, Go for it.
Yeah, there's that. We got a quick correction. Tensor Guy wants to point out correctly the plutonium is not found in any measurable quantities in the wild. Thank you for that.
Dude, Tensor Guy knows his stuff, man. He's a smart cat.
You have to. Plutonium has to be manufactured.
That's true.
Lawrence Livermore
does
all
that. But uranium would be.
He knows that I know this, but he still wanted to tweak.
He's good.
I mean, every generation tends to, like, not everybody. There is that sort of thinking like, oh, this is it. Which is really not in your case, but it's a very arrogant kind of thing, you know, because you hear people like, oh, the world this day. And we've been living in, like, you know, decades of the most prosperous, peaceful time on the history of the planet, and people don't know it.
Well, I'll tell you, man, the rational optimist, the rational optimist, the rational optimist. Everyone needs to read that book.
Ridley, Matt Ridley. We'll do two more and then we'll go to picks.
Yeah.
Cool. Question is, where do you see Justin in 10 years?
Man, that's a really good question. Because I don't know, like, with you, I see a very specific, ambitious thread and what direction you want to go. And I think with me, you know.
Don't be so sure.
Yeah, right. But, like, with Justin, I'm not entirely sure what he wants, man. I think that's what we love about him, is that he's sort of a. Like a jack of all trades. He's able to do so much interesting stuff. I could see him writing for television or for TV shows or I don't know.
I'd like to see him in, you know, Jimmy Fallon's seat.
That's true.
I totally think he could, like, host a talk show.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. In fact, if you've never listened, he does these Jury Saturdays where he does, like, a one-mic radio show, which I find horrifying and very challenging to even wrap my mind around. The idea of just talking straight for an hour and keeping yourself entertained and entertaining other people. But he does a fantastic job with it.
Yeah. So who knows? Tensor Guy said, what is your opinion of ocean colonies?
I'm for them. You're talking about like the seasteading kind of thing?
I guess you're saying ocean colonies in general, maybe under the ocean?
Yes, all of the above. Above the ocean, below the ocean, in the clouds.
You know, it's funny. I always love those shows where, like, or the movie, the premise, like, oh, we've so polluted the Earth, we've got to go to another planet, and we're living inside of spaceships, or we're living inside of dome buildings. Like, why not just build them on Earth?
Yeah.
You know, if the environment you're on this other planet so hostile, build it on Earth, you know?
Yeah, I'm okay with that.
It's bad sci-fi thinking. Professor Chaos writes, how long do you think we have until resources are gone from the Earth?
Never. We will never run out. And that's not to say that the amount will not get very low, but as the lower the amount of whatever the resource is gets low, the drive to figure out an alternate way to handle things will get higher. And as a result, there will always be some left on the table for, like, let's take oil, for example, right? Let's say we get to the last 200 gallons of oil in the entire planet. At that point, it's not worth it to set it on fire as a way to propel your cars anymore. So instead, you find other ways to do it, and you leave that last 200 gallons. But then you come up with, I don't know, some novel new medical procedure where all of a sudden it's worth it to spend tens of thousands of dollars to extract just a thimbleful of oil. Then we do it with that.
We talked about before, there are all these other things. Like right now you have methane hydrates, which are these basically crystallized ice of methane. Generally you find them under the ocean, and there's more of that than there's oil. Okay?
Wow.
And it's just expensive to extract it. We're getting better at extracting the stuff, but there's more of that than there's oil right now. And the amount of natural gas we have can take us 100 years or more into the future and can produce energy. When you start getting into the methane hydrates, things like this, we have so much more available energy in these things that are only – they're not – and it means that, you know, it when gas gets to $10 a gallon, which – we'll probably see closer than we want to. Then methane hype things, it becomes, oh, it's more practical to do that. You know, the extraction process.
Right. Well, and in the Rational Optimist, I haven't double checked on this, but he says that there's never been a case of a non-renewable resource vanishing, running out of something. But there have been lots of cases of renewable resources being overtaxed because of the tragedy of the commons. There mm-hmm. are plenty of times that you know, forests have been completely destroyed because, you know, they'll grow back, they're renewable, but then everyone overtaxes it and they destroy the forest.
Yeah, we kind of look at it like, well, now we have to go offshore to get oil. Well, yeah, because it was easier to get the oil that was inshore, and we still get inshore oil, and now we're finding ways to get more oil out of reserves we didn't think that we could get them. And that's one of the reasons that the idea of peak oil, we're still going, are we at peak oil? Are we not? And it's 2012. This was a thing that some people said we hit 30 years ago. 30 yeah. years later, it shouldn't be an ambiguous question.
Right. Absolutely.
So,
you want to think?
And is that it? So, let's do picks.
Man, I am on a kick. I'm on a very specific direction, a theme. All of the media I'm consuming is all different versions of the exact same story. What do you think that story is? Do you know? I'm thinking of four different things. One, two, three. Wait, maybe three. But they're all essentially the same calamity.
I'm going to say, Brian, you have got into Space 1999 fanfic.
Very close, actually. Not at all. I started reading one minute after? I think it's 1 minute after. Let me find out who it's by. But it's I'm doing it on Audible, and wait for it. I'm calling it up right now.
So, Brian, one of the things I love about this show is the spontaneity and how well prepared we all are when we do the show.
1 second.
As I say this, I'm going to be thinking of my pick because I still don't know what I'm going to say.
All right, it's 1 second after by William Forschen. And it's way good because the basically postulates that at some point They haven't even figured out who at this point. But at some point, all the electronics go out because somebody has detonated a couple of nukes out in space that rained down an EMP that wiped out all of the electricity-driven objects in our world. And it's great because it starts off very, you know, people shrugging their shoulders like, okay, what was that? Oh, well, the lights will come on eventually. But then by day four, already people are starting to realize that they've got to start worrying about resources. People in the town think about it. It's, you know, there's us versus the outsiders. Then,
there's a huge genre now of like the EMP or the technology ending thing. It's fascinating.
Well, that's the other thing, right? Because as I'm reading this book, I check out the new show Revolution that's from J.J. Abrams. Which is not nearly as good as the book because it sort of just picks up 15 years later when just no more electronics and people are living in little farms or whatever. And yet they're all mysteriously very attractive and clean and very, very fashionable.
Yeah,
dressed.
It's the cozy apocalypse problem.
Yes, exactly.
You know, you get like, I'm glad it happened. I'm glad billions of people died,
right,
you know?
Right, exactly. But then likewise, also H+ is essentially the same story, except instead of modern electronics, it projects a future in which we all become dependent on these implants that allow us to access the internet at all times. And that the computer virus wipes out the people who have these implants, but it's an interesting genre. But out of all the different flavors I'm experiencing, I like One Second After the most because it gives you a very tangible descent into the chaos that would await us. You know, it's like you see each phase, you're like, yeah, no, I guess people would start to riot about this kind of thing, and I guess people would freak out, and I guess they would become territorial, and I guess you would start to see cities turn against other cities that are their neighbors just because they're trying to hold on to their rations long enough.
You know, there is that interesting point, like you said, is that the messy period is sometimes people want to go jump ahead because you go like, well, what happens after the apocalypse? Like, what happens in the middle of the apocalypse?
What happens during the apocalypse? That's the exciting thing.
Yeah, I'm trying to find a thing that I watched here, which I will use to compliment your pick. I may have picked it before, but it would go good with that.
While you're doing that, let me just point out that if you want to see the NBC pilot of Revolution, it's available right now. They released it like 2 weeks or a week or two before the actual pilot's place on television, which is usually not a good indication. They don't usually give away stuff for free ahead of time when they're confident that it's going to be a big hit. But you could check. Just look for Revolution Pilot NBC.
Yeah, I remember when the first time they did that was the first 7 minutes of Memento.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and I'm like, I gotta see this movie.
Oh my god! No, see, because the first time I saw it was the first 10 minutes of Serenity, and of course Serenity didn't do nearly as well as Memento in its projections.
Yeah. So, this was a documentary produced in the United Kingdom, by the way, where Angel Killers currently ranked to the number 12th best.
That was smooth. Very, well
very
done.
Good taste there. Very, very good taste those people have. I just have to ignore Justin's horrific, insulting comments he made in the podcast we recorded at Dragacon, which will air. I just said that like Dragacon, like Shaka Con. I kind of like that. Dragacon. Dragacon, Dragacon. This was a really, I watched this, it was done in 1965, it was a Best Documentary Feature Award in that year, I'm reading this, and it was this, what would happen, a 1965 point of view, if there was nuclear war between the United States and Russia, and Britain was collateral because they had an Air Force base there, whatever, and they got nuked. And so it's this pseudo-documentary showing you as if it was actually happening, watching this documentary of explaining what happens. The lead up, everything happens in the 1965 kind of idea, and it's very gripping, very, very gripping kind of thing, and very, very British in the way that it's done. And they use a combination of archival footage, they shot stuff, all that, and you just see this, it's this very kind of frightening thing about, you know, what would happen. And now, you know, thankfully, you know, we have many, many more nuclear weapons, and if for some reason we actually wanted to use them, we can skip right past the suffering and right into the incineration phase.
Right into the depths. Yeah, thank goodness they got that all worked out.
So there's that.
Amazing. So wait, what was the title of this?
That's The War Game, and it's on Netflix streaming. You can watch that. And it is right there on the Netflix. So check it out. That's my pick, The War Game.
Right on, sir. Well, I definitely feel like there was a little something missing this episode. I'll be excited to have Justin back, but it was fun.
Oh yeah, Justin.
It was fun just to geek out and get a little sciencey up in this.
Yeah, we could do this more often without what's-his-face.
I got nothing.
You know, it's kind of funny. As I'm looking at sort of the setup of my bookcase there, and it's kind of like you're in back of me, and I'm like, hey, Brad, tell me that again.
Wait, wait, are you seeing it reverse?
Yeah, the way it's, like, my image, the way, it, like, you're over there, but if I kind of, like, it's kind of like a split, like, they use one of those cameras with, like, the split focus. So
yeah, so it looks like we're actually in the room together, and, yeah.
That's true, yeah.
Yeah.
So. Whatever.
It's good seeing you, bro.
Wait, yeah, how's that look?
Actually, it looks pretty good. It looks like we're in the same room together. This is going to go great for the audio listeners.
Nice hat. Yeah. Well, it's been weird.
You want to sponsor the podcast? Do you have $30? If so, go to weirdthings.com/sponsor and you can have Justin say whatever you want. He's a trained ape.